Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is May 19th, 2016. We are, what, a month away from E3 at this point?
Meh.
And, yeah, and meh. I mean, yeah, we'll be there. It's episode 477. Not quite the production of last week, such as it was, because it's not 10-year anniversary anymore. However, I am joined by the return of Mr. John Lindemann.
Yeah, you know, I figured what better way to, you know, spend the 10th than just not being on the podcast, so.
There you go.
10 years, ooh, yeah.
The best part is you have no idea what we said about you, so it's a good feeling to know that we took shots for at least a solid minute.
Yeah,
and it's just
I might have to give that a listen.
I seem to is just that you this 10 years is such a tiny fraction of your life that you didn't really see it as a particularly big milestone.
Yeah, much like a vampire, it just kind of after several hundred years, it just kind of loses the luster,
washes over you after a while.
Yep,
we've all been there. We've all been there.
I've seen empires also rise and fall, Greg.
Yes, if you didn't catch that, Mr. Greg Lay is also with us today.
I take umbrage with the suggestion that the British Empire has fallen.
You tell me.
That's right. You have two disloyal subjects on the show, Greg. You should handle it.
Yeah, I know.
One of them escaped. I mean, one of them got out. Please deal with it.
I thought our friend was going to sort that out. I was reliably informed.
Our friend.
What? You gotta wait till January, Greg.
Okay.
Oh.
Bated breath.
Oh, now to be sorted out. That's good stuff.
There's some really dark meaning to that phrasing. Lastly, I'm joined by Mr. Guillaume Fayette.
The intro about E3 being boring is kind of far away now, but I just want to say that usually I'm not even excited for E3, even when they're promising. So.
That's
dark.
Guillaume wakes up on Christmas and goes, it's just another day.
Yep.
Basically.
Hey, it's time for new business.
Yeah, it's one hell of an intro.
Greg.
Yes.
What are you playing this week?
Yeah, so it's Fire Emblem Day in Europe. Fire Emblem is finally coming out. Fates, all the various versions and all of that. But I used the impending arrival of Fire Emblem as a sort of impetus to get something done that was sort of fallen through the cracks a bit of the RPG maelstrom, which is Mario and Luigi Paper Jam. I suppose I'm kind of obliged to say Paper Jam Brothers, considering that is what it says on my box of the game for some reason. But it's the fifth Mario and Luigi game since the first one came along in 2003, I think it was. So yeah, it's there's been quite a few of them at this point, and I've played all of them. I'm a big fan of them, especially the first and third ones, Superstar Saga and Bowser's Inside Story. But you know, I would have kind of liked to get to this earlier, but I mean, if you recall, it came out a little earlier here than it did in the States. I think it was actually the same day as Xenoblade Chronicles X. And so, even obviously,
sent out to die.
They're very different games, to say the least. Even though they both, you know, have an RPG strain to them, but you know, Xenoblade came along, big time thing. I don't know whether you know this, and I'll come back around to that. And then by the time I was kind of the palate had been cleansed and I was ready for maybe a portable RPG, I went to Bravely Second. That came out early here, of course, compared to the States as well. So I kind of thought, I resolved that I would get this done before Fire Emblem arrived, and I haven't quite done it, actually. I've put over 20 some odd hours into it, but I haven't quite finished it yet. I'm confident I'm close to the end, but hopefully get that sorted before I delve deep into Fire Emblem. But like I said, look, I do love these games, but Dream Team or Dream Team Brothers in Europe again. It was, you know, a bit of a step back in some ways, I feel like, compared to Bowser's Inside Story. Mainly, I guess, because it was more of a, just a step sideways in that it was very, very much like a reprise of Bowser's Inside Story, substituting Bowser for Luigi in terms of, you know, the sort of dichotomy between an overworld and a sort of underworld where instead of Bowser's belly, it's Luigi's brain in a dream and giant battles involving Luigi and all this kind of stuff. You know, it was very much sort of blow for blow kind of alternate version as much of a sequel, but just didn't quite do it as well. You know, it wasn't as well written, it wasn't as well paced. There's lots of good things about it. It's still an enjoyable game. But certainly I think the issue of pacing seemed to come to a head with that one. It was probably the longest of the Mario & Luigi games for me to, you know, get to the end of. And, you know, a lot of that felt like it was because they kind of, you know, the two issues really. Some of it was in the kind of the actual design of the game, you know, some tasks that seemed like they were there to kind of elongate it. But then also in the writing, you know, there just seemed to be a lot of text that could have been condensed. And so, you know, with this game coming out, just as it did at the end of last year, I was kind of interested to see, you know, with the reviews and impressions and whatnot, how much they addressed those, some of those issues in this case. And, you know, I'm pretty pleased with some of the changes or adjustments that they've made here, although they're not, you know, extraordinary in scope, believe me. I mean, it's still very much the same sort of game that it's been since the first one in 2003. I mean, I remember we said about there's certain kinds of games Nintendo's quite happy to churn out regularly, and they usually tend to be the sort of mega sellers. Well, this is one example where it's not as successful, and yet they still, they obviously must be happy with how they do, because they come along every sort of 3 years or so and put out another one that's broadly similar. But in this case, you could see that some of the feedback about pacing got back to them. Because there's a number of elements, like you can actually fast forward dialogue scenes, not just in terms of the text coming up, but actually sort of the way it plays out. You know, some of the little sort of pantomimes that go on with this series, with Luigi sort of looking perplexed and going, bleh, 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 you know, like that kind of stuff. Just, you can actually just speed that up. The way it looks, it kind of be that long. And also, I mean, the way they've approached the story with this one is, and this is something that's kind of reared its head with other kind of Mario spin-off games, is that to basically have no outside characters at all. It's all just established Mario characters. So, for instance, compared to Dream Team, there is no Pillow Kingdom for you to learn the lore of, on, you know, the whatever artifacts there were in the Pillow Kingdom, all that kind of stuff. So it's a sort of, you know, so I think you can imagine for some people it's kind of not a great thing, because, you know, there have been some very sort of beloved original characters that have come out of Mario RPGs in the past. You know, but for instance, everybody seemed to like Fourfall as the villain in the first and third games, but he was just an original creation. In this, it's all just pure bred Mario characters from various sources. And so it kind of, but that does seem to help them have a certain economy with storytelling, so less exposition, less like, let's establish this character, like what his or her thing is that makes him funny or something, because you already know them. It's assumed you know sort of what their shtick is already. So, you know, I remember one particularly sort of tedious bit of Dream Team that sticks out to me was this sort of like Pillow Kingdom equivalent of Hans and Franz. You know, sort of fitness, and they just talked so much without saying anything, and yeah, it was you know, that sort of stuff is basically gone by focusing just on these sort of pre-existing characters that you don't really have to set up very much.
But is the localization the same in Europe and in North America?
Well, the spellings are correct for here. I can confirm that. They've, you know, I saw the correct spelling for us of maneuver, which is sometimes one that gets overlooked. So, yeah good job. You know,
ER versus RE, right? I'm assuming.
Yeah, that's right. RE for us.
Maneuver.
Yeah, but I'm mostly asking because, you know, there's been, apparently, yes, people care about localization.
Oh, and, sure, yeah.
They felt that the U.S. translations were a little bit too meme-y
I was just pissed that they took out the boob slider. That really pissed me off.
Well, we can work on that for you, John.
Toadette braid slider. Yeah, that was taken out, sadly. No, it's, it's still got the same sort of whimsical approach in terms of the dialogue. There are some kind of fourth wall-y kind of breaking moments, but I don't know whether it's that, like, just sort of, it's not really general memes or anything. There's a lot of fun at Luigi's expense in this one. Whereas it's funny because he was obviously like the hero of the previous game, and pretty much to spend this game making cracks about useless years. And then at some point, Starlo, the little sort of guide character, is left alone with Luigi, the Mario and Paper Mario. Are out of it, and so it's just up to those two to help. And he spent the whole game slagging Luigi off, and he's like, I don't really know what to say. You could do it, Luigi. You had a whole year named after you. It's okay. So it's a little wow. bit of sort of referencing stuff. That's like a slam against the year of Luigi. Pretty dire sales wise. I think we all remember that. Apart from, well, Luigi's Mansion 2 sold well, I guess. And new Super Luigi U is very good. It's not about the quality or anything, but you know, this, it's still got that sort of charm to it. It's just a bit more economical than before, so that's fine with me. Yeah. I think the biggest stuff, gameplay wise now, you know, you've got rid of kind of the underworld aspect, you know, this time in Paper Mario's along for the ride. You have a party of three, but there's not like this separate side scrolling kind of areas or anything like that. What they focus more on is kind of remixing areas and giving you new tasks to do in them. And the results there are kind of mixed. I think the sort of environment designs are generally pretty good, but again, sometimes they stretch it a bit too far with like new things to do in them. You may have heard, if you've or read, I should say, perhaps if you've looked at reviews, some complaints about the number of like paper toad quests. This is where, you know, so some number of all these Paper Mario characters are exploding out of a book and falling from the sky, and there's some toads have freaked out by this, and you've got to go and calm them down and collect them up. And you've got a lot of these quests that sort of make up quite a bit of a game, and you know they can be quite different in nature. You know, sort of more mini game esque, sort of almost little puzzles, and then others, you know, are just more the sort of the typical scavenger hunt, and those are definitely tend to be the weakest. I feel like ultimately, you know, they probably could have looked at what they had and taken out some of the weaker ones, and then it would have been pretty acceptable. I don't object to the general idea of giving these environments new tasks within them, because they do some interesting things, especially if you like ones where you're working against the clock, because that sort of brings in a new resource constraint to think about in battle. Because as a lot of people kind of noted over the years, some of the big major sort of team up attacks can be which do the most damage, of course, the sort of little mini games you play, you know, time button presses, all that, they could take a long time to execute. But of course, normally you're concerned with just how much damage you could do in a turn. But when you're actually fighting against the clock, you know, a hard time that's just running all the time through battle, now it's like, okay, well, how much damage could I do fast rather than how many turns you could do in it? So I thought that was kind of cool. You know, it gave you a different sort of emphasis, a different spin on battles and things like that. So they had
And you have, I guess, to look at the animations of the attacks. No?
That's right, yeah. Yeah. I mean, in some cases, I was doing things like, for instance, like deliberately not getting the right timing on a jump with Luigi, because I just wanted him to get his attack out of the way so I could use someone else's attack that was going to be the perfect one to wipe out the whole enemy party in one turn. You know, things like this. You know, it's just an interesting sort of another resource constraint applied to that battle, you know, sort of engine that they've got set up there, which I like a lot. I mean, I think the one thing I do feel like, and I have felt like for a long time, hasn't changed, is that I would like it if there was a way to streamline maybe the regular battles more. I'm quite happy with the boss battles being really quite protracted and kind of complex and really involved battles. They're very rewarding to me. I really enjoy those sort of complex attack patterns. I mean, that's it, because it's more than just the time button presses. For me, where this battle engine that they've had in the Mario and Luigi games really shines is the dodging, is jumping, evading attacks. And then on top of that, if you get it really right, actually, you're not just, say, jumping over a projectile that someone's firing, but getting it just right so you jump on top of it and send it back at them. And that's really how you can, radically speed up your killing of the enemies, because you instead of taking damage, you're dealing it in their turns. You could really get it going quickly. But for the regular battles, I still kind of feel like sometimes they go on a bit longer than you'd like. I mean, the good news is they're not like random or anything, of course, as ever. You can avoid them to whatever extent you'd like, but of course, you do need to build up your character, and you want to build up your character. You want it to improve and give it new sort of, you get these sort of perks every through few levels where you go up a rank, and things like that. So, I mean, it is the kind of game where you certainly don't have to grind, because as I said, I mean, you don't have to take damage at all. You can pretty much always avoid it. That's one of the things I really like about this RPG sort of setup for Mario and Luigi. But I think if they could make the enemy attack patterns maybe sped up a bit, or maybe limit which sort of attacks you use against them in the regular battles to just keep the pacing a little bit more fluid would be fine with me, and then sort of put the onus of the big focus on those epic boss battles. That would probably be a little adjustment that I would like. But in general, I felt like the experience here, while it's not radically different from Dream Team at all, it really benefited from all these little economies, sort of putting more tutorials as optional, especially because some of the attacks you will have done before if you've played these games before. You're being able to speed up the cutscenes, the script being less loquacious than it was. It's all these things really add up to just, like I said, although there's still some issues with these additional quests that I don't think were needed, and the regular battles sometimes get you bogged down. It's been a much more sort of crisp, enjoyable experience this time. And these games are really, really well made. The sprite work is great. One of the nice things about the focus on Mario characters is you just get to see some that you might not have seen before in this really great pixel art style, like Koopa Kids and Charging Chucks and all this. It's not just like random characters that you've never seen before. It's nice to see actual characters given this treatment. They look great.
It's not the Pillow Kingdom.
Yeah, exactly. These characters look really great in this art style. They've sort of tweaked it a little bit to sort of create a bit of a dichotomy with the paper stuff, because they've sort of given the regular environments a bit more detail, I think, so that when gradually, like, the paper element starts sort of worming its way into the environment and it gets taken over by these like cardboard structures and stuff, but of course they haven't got detail, they look meant to look like cardboard, so it kind of brings out the contrast a bit. But ideally the contrast would probably be greater, but especially because you have these flat pixel art characters running around a 3D world, it's not that different from Paper Mario. Sometimes the difference seems mainly to be they have a white outline around the paper versions, but so that's not ideal, but you still get the idea. And the paper stuff does add a little bit of stuff to different abilities, attributes for enemies. They have unique kind of status effects. They can have like being crumpled or creased, and the oftentimes, in fact, the sort of paper versions provide a very literal change up in the baseball sense, in that they will attack a bit slower than their regular counterparts. So it's a totally predictable thing. Every now and again, it'll catch you out. So all these little wrinkles and stuff are just, I think it's been a pretty significant improvement. I've not quite got to the end yet, but I'm close, and I'm pretty happy to say it's above Dream Team for me, but you know, it's not as fresh as Bowser's Inside Story was back when that came out. It didn't bring as much new to the table as that, so I think it'd be hard pressed to surpass that one as my favorite of the lot.
Let me ask a bit of a tangential question here. So Alpha Dream has been doing these games for a long time.
Yeah, since before 2003, naturally. They didn't make it overnight. You know?
Yeah. Do you think maybe they need to do something else just to shake it up a little bit?
I really like these games. So, you know, even the ones that, like Partners in Time and Dream Team, which were not, I didn't feel quite as well executed as the others, I still enjoyed them. So I'm not going to tell them to go off and do something else just willy nilly. But I mean, they've done five. They've honed it to a significant degree. I kind of feel like there's diminishing returns there to some extent. I wouldn't mind them doing something else, because they seem like they always produce a really kind of polished looking product. It seems like they've got, not that they're infallible or anything, but yeah, that you feel like their sensibilities could be brought to something else and do something good with it. But like I said, well, even though these games are not huge sellers, they must be, you know, good enough to keep going to the well. And it does keep giving us another Shimomura soundtrack, which is always good. I don't think this one seems as memorable as Dream Team's yet. That was probably the best thing about that game. Shimomura soundtrack for that was great. This one is probably just very good, but it still is that. It's a great sounding game.
So, Guillaume.
Yes. I'm still in the, how do you say that, in the thrall of Pocket Card Jockey. Yeah, I just can't turn myself away from it. And my latest horse was actually, had a witch hat, and I named her Kiki after the Hayao Miyazaki film. And I guess when, she retires and, the breeding bit, I guess her foal is going to be Kiki's Delivery. So, I think I just tipped my hand as to what my top game of 2016 is going to be. But
it's deep, all the way.
I like part of me wants to start booing, but I don't think I can get enough boos out. So let's continue.
I'm just glad you're hating everything, Guillaume.
Unlike somebody here.
Well, wait, I'm not done.
Which horse is Gigi in this scenario? By the way.
I've got no idea. We'll see. I haven't seen, actually, there is a nerdy kind of horse, but, he's more of a kind of Matt Smith impersonator, like the Doctor Who with like the,
as horses are wont to do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the toupee is a little bit more Trumpy, but, the bow tie is definitely, kind of Doctor Who-ish. Yeah, so to not disappoint John, I guess I'm going to start hating on something.
Yeah!
I've been playing a little bit of the copy of Rogue Squadron 3D that I got on May the 4th GOG.com. So, the PC version. Don't really have that much experience with the N64 version, actually. The version I played was the PC version. And that's kind of the problem, because I've played this game kind of completely. I'm pretty sure I finished it 100%. I unlocked, I think, the final mission, final bonus mission was, like, you played as the Millennium Falcon, and you were killing world destroyers from Dark Empire, a Star Wars comic. I used to be kind of a Star Wars nerd. So I finished it back in the day, and now going back to this, I'm faced with the prospect of kind of trying to get gold medals in every level, and I don't really see why I should do that. You know, it just seemed like a good idea to get this game for $5 when it was on sale on May the 4th. But then I actually started playing, and I'm like, "Well, I've done this before. I'm not sure if I really want to go back to this." And besides, like, it's not really, you know, like, you go to the games that you played a lot when you were a kid and, or a teenager. I was quite old, actually. I wasn't a kid anymore. But you realize there's just way more warts than you remembered, you know. This game is really hard to go back to, even after playing something like Star Fox Zero, which is so derided. It's, you know, actually, Star Fox Zero, you shoot where you aim. And in Rogue Squadron 3D, you aim at something, and there's so much kind of aim assist that your lasers go all over the place, and they don't seem to go at the target, they don't seem to go where the target is going, they just seem to be to have a mind of their own. And when you're, you know, in a shooting flying game like this, it's not a good feeling when you feel like, well, I guess I have to put my reticle kind of around the area where the enemies are, and hopefully the lasers will ding find their target, you know. And yeah, like, one of the other things that's kind of annoying is that this game is kind of unplayable when you're playing in third person view. You often have to do, like, to turn on a dime because TIE fighters just went past you, right? So you hit the air brakes and you turn, and when you do that, the camera doesn't actually follow you. Like, sometimes you can end up facing the camera,
which is
silly because, you know, like, you're trying to shoot at something.
Yeah.
Don't show me the front of the ship, right? So that's annoying. And it also does that thing, which, you know, Star Fox also does, like the three aiming reticles when you're in third person. That's supposed to help you aim your shots, and it just doesn't work all that well. Plus, the aim assist, as I was saying, it's just annoying. And to kind of, like, compounding that problem, you are rated on various metrics at the end of a level, like how fast you completed the mission, how many enemies you killed, and your accuracy. And so when you miss by 3%, like the gold medal for the mission, because, yeah, your accuracy was off by 3%, and it feels like it wasn't even your fault, it's kind of shitty. Mm-hmm. So I'm just, I guess I'm not going to bother too much about the medals. I've seen the extra levels that they unlock, so I don't really mind. I'm going to finish it, and I'll move on. But it's kind of hard to go back to this game. And it's funny because I kind of had better memories of the first Rogue Squadron than the GameCube ones, because the GameCube ones I played way past, like, the release. I didn't get a GameCube until, like, a year and a half into its life. And I was kind of underwhelmed after all the praise. I found the game too dark. It was kind of annoying to pull down the computer assist to see the outlines of the TIE fighters against the blackness of space. So, you know, at least this game, the N64 game, had, like, kind of almost, like, garish colors. The power-ups that you can find or, like, these big yellow cubes instead of gray bolts that you find in the blackness of space in the GameCube game. So I just remembered the first game as being more fun than its sequels. And now I realize, well, maybe not.
So I guess I'm curious. My memories of Rogue Squadron on the N64 are not the initial playthrough, although I played that game a ton. Uh-huh. It's all the weird, like, secondary cheats and stuff that came out later, all the crazy Easter eggs. Does all that stuff survive into the PC version? Like, can you go get into that, like, weirdly distinted and elongated Naboo starfighter they put in years before the movie came out?
Was that in the N64 version?
Yeah, that was a huge thing, because they put it in there behind a cheat code, but obviously Rogue Squadron came out, what, like, about
3 years at least.
Was it more than a year? I thought it was like a year.
Because Battle for Naboo came out the year of the movie.
I can't remember if it was 2000 or 99 for the Battle of Naboo, but yeah, I mean, there was the whole Naboo game, but yeah, that was in there, and of course, at the time, there was this whole, like, lockdown with episode one stuff before they blew everything out. And, you know, these days, obviously, just would have been hacked and everyone would have known everything in it straight away.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was there the whole time. And then once, you know, they got the go ahead from Lucasfilm or whatever, then they divulged the code and you could play as the episode one fighter.
But there's also other weird stuff like that Buick you could fly around. It was a weird, like, magical thing about that game where every so often Nintendo Power would have this, like, six code long code. It's like, hey, just try it out. And you'd go and you'd try it, and you'd freak out and go, oh my god, what is this Starfighter? What is any of this?
So, yeah, it does have, like, you can input cheat codes and stuff, but, and I just checked this, so I remembered correctly. In the PC version, you actually got the Naboo Starfighter with a patch. So it's not as impressive. I guess that it was easier to go and, like, look at the files in the PC version.
Yeah.
So they didn't want to risk it. They didn't want to risk people just finding out before it was time. So, yeah, it just makes sense. But, yeah, there's various, like, weird cheats and stuff. Usually they're different in the N64 and the PC game, but probably the results are the same.
December 1998, Rogue Squadron came out.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, it's a 6 months then. It was 6 months before Phantom Menace came out.
Right.
Maybe they just sat on it for a while. Oh, it was a 69 Buick Electra. Sorry, not... I think the memory most people have of this game is just how crazy it was. Like, it was the first time that you really had this arcadey feel of like a Star Wars fighter versus, you know, you had your X-Wing and your TIE Fighter game, and then you had X-Wing versus TIE Fighter, which, but those were very, like, early to mid 90s sim flying games, which was kind of this thing before the casualization of the flight genre. Like, there was a weird thing coming into the 90s on PC games where there was this rush to be more and more complicated because games had been really simple at that point. And so it became like, I'm going to have the most complicated flight game in space. Well, no, I'm going to have the most complicated flight game. And so this was sort of a big step back from that bridge. It was real full 3D. And it was just a different kind of game. And it felt really cool. And I can understand now playing it going like, what the fuck?
Mm. The ships always seem to either turn too much or not enough, and like the game has turned on by default, like a lot of assists, like auto roll to be level with the ground, and stuff like that, and it really needs it because it's disorienting, but also sometimes it just feels like the ship shouldn't turn the way it does, I don't know, it's weird.
I mean, nothing about the craft in Star Wars makes any physics sense anyway, to some degree.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
it's all just nonsense chaos. So at some point, like, yeah, sure, why not have it auto turn? But I know what you're talking about. There is a weird, it's got its own particular breed of funk to it. Like, in how that game controls that goes through that series. I do think it gets better, or it gets, like, the clarity of action and purpose gets better, and the controls kind of get closer to what they want, and you have more fidelity of control as things go. But yeah, I don't think it ever really gets all the way there, because it does sort of feel like they were very much quickly turning those games out, and then that series was just unceremoniously killed.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a bummer. I would have liked to have seen maybe one more and seen where it went.
Well, of course, there's the revelation that Level Factor 5 was working on did complete a like trilogy, Wii version trilogy.
Yep.
And they just never got published.
It would have been cool to see it. It would have been very cool to see it. But that's okay. It freed them up to make Lair.
Great.
John. Oh, Lair. All right. Yeah, so this week I'm not playing games, James. I'm playing The Market, buddy.
The most dangerous game.
Yeah, it's the most dangerous game. So I have, I mean, probably to the surprise of nobody here, I have several dozens of games that I could potentially put up on eBay, right? So
binders full of games.
Binders full of games, of course. So yeah, so the ones I'm actually putting up are going to be my Game Boy Advance games. Now,
John, we're not turning this into your pitch of the selling. Like,
no.
You can find this game at www.
This may wind up being self-serving, but I'll use Twitter for that. So
you're a monster.
So what this is? So what I'm doing is I pulled out all of my Game Boy Advance games. The thing is with Game Boy Advance games, the reason why I'm selling them is because a lot of these ones they kind of occupy an interesting niche right now, collectability wise, because you can't, like, there's still a high demand for them, so I'm finding, and that's because you can't really play these games in a lot of different ways outside of playing them on the Game Boy Advance. There's a couple of them out there, like on the VC, for playing, but a lot of them are still.
I mean, there's emulators.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to pirate anything, you can get whatever, but legitimately, if you want to play them, you know, and
yeah,
you know, officially, they're still kind of hard to find. So my theory is, I think I'd be curious to see how this theory of mine actually holds water as time goes on. But I think that the kind of golden era for you playing any sort of video game is probably maybe like your early teenage years to maybe like your mid 20s kind of thing. Like that's where like you play the games that you really, really fall in love with. And that's like the games that you like the most, right? So I think 15 years from that is when you're kind of going to be like, man, I really wish I could play those games again. So if you look back, so these games have been out for about 15 years. A lot of these games are kind of from like around 2001-ish, maybe 2001 yep. to 2006 maybe. So they've been out for about 15 years, 10, 15 years. So all the people that were maybe in their teenage years back when they came out are now like kind of like nearing approaching 30 and probably have a job and have some cash to toss around. So I was like, hey, let's go on eBay and find out what some of these games are worth. So the one that the thing is, what surprised me, a couple of things surprised me. So usually you think that the big, or at least I would come in thinking that the most popular Nintendo games probably wouldn't fetch the most money because there were so many copies made of them. But the GBA games are kind of different. For example, now this isn't the biggest series, or it wasn't the biggest series at the time. This is actually an interesting one because it's become a big series, is Fire Emblem. I have a copy of Fire Emblem The Sacred Stones, and it is in immaculate condition. It's not sealed, but it's a complete inbox, nothing on it. I mean, it looks like you just pulled it out of the shrink wrap.
You can find it on ebay.com/Jay Lindemann.
I haven't listed any of these yet. I've just been going through, but it goes.
Well, no, because if you listed them, we would be able to sell them now.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I'm going to be listing some of these things because, I mean, it goes for between $65 to $100, pretty much.
I can believe it.
Yeah. And wow. I'm looking at completed listings too. I'm not looking at ones that are out there.
So, John, I could speak a little bit about that game in particular mm-hmm. and its marketability.
Yeah.
When Nintendo started bringing over the Fire Emblem games, and that's the second one they brought over, I think. The first one's just called Fire Emblem.
Yeah, right.
They had no real concept of, like, what is this game going to do? And as a result, they didn't make that many of them. Because GBA was still a cartridge, there was still relatively important and costs to consider when you made runs of games. And so you have a lot of these games that have relatively limited runs, smaller mm-hmm. than you would expect.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's where your problems come in. Because a relatively mediocre GameCube game like Gacha Force with pretty low runs is now worth way more money than any right-minded human being would ever pay for it.
Yes.
So John, what have you been seeing?
So Fire Emblem, I'm assuming, I wish that, you know, I could track these prices over time, because I'm pretty sure that Fire Emblem probably in the last several years has skyrocketed in value, Sacred Stones, as the series, especially now. Like right now, I would think that right now would be the best time if you have an old Fire Emblem game. Now would probably be the best time to sell it because of the sudden explosion in popularity of Fire Emblem. So
I would say maybe not if you're in Europe. I would say give
yeah,
true,
very true. This is all American. Take some
time. Yeah, give me a little bit of time to play through Conquest first. I mean, I got Sacred Stones to the Ambassador program. That's how I got it. I mean, I remember like looking into buying the GBA Fire Emblems like a little bit late to the party, and at that time Sacred Stones wasn't that hard to get hold of. This is probably like 8 years ago, you know, sort of time, but the original GBA Fire Emblem, that must have had a really, to James' point about them being cautious with it, I think that had a pretty small run, because that has gone for a lot of money for a long time. And, you know, I can only assume, given your sort of 15-year cycle hypothesis, and the popularity of the franchise growing, it's probably gone up even more in the years hence. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now the other one that I think is I think this probably holds true to the small print run theory, because this one really surprised me, was a 2001 game by Orbital Media, Racing Gears Advance. Really good game. Really, really good, kind of really good racing game. But this one, Racing Gears Advance, very few copies on eBay, and it's actually hard to even find one that's sold. But they're going for, now sealed, I couldn't find one complete in box, but sealed, they're going for $140, $165 bucks. So that was surprising. I mean, none of these are completed listings, but they're being listed. I mean, here's actually one that's complete, game in box, one for $100. So that's a valuable game. That really surprised me.
It seems really only valuable to collectors, though.
Absolutely.
I mean, yep. For people to play, why would you even get that?
That one, I guess, is not going to get digitally re-released. You know, Fire Emblem, obviously, has been digitally re-released. But something like that. Or presumably Ninja 5-0, you know, is like my big GBA game I'd love to get, but it's ridiculously expensive.
The same rules don't apply. It's a totally different type of criteria. It's like, was it a
and
low John print
is
run?
Right. Like a collector's dream. Like, he's like the farm. Like
I'm the guy that has the Shelby Mustang, you know, locked away in the farmhouse.
No, because right. I mean, you bought all these games at the time, and you know, kept them in nice condition because you may not have played them all that much in every case. I think we've sort of covered that over the years, and so you've got then you're willing to part with them. So you are the collector's dream, John.
I have become the gaming grandma, I guess. Let me
ask you a question, John.
Oh God, sure, James.
Fire Emblem Awakening.
I thought you were Grandpappy Gamer, John.
Yeah, you're right. It's all come full circle.
That's an old reference. Good lord.
Fire Emblem Awakening. When did that come out?
2013.
Yeah, so in the lead up to that, February, Fire Emblem Sacred Stones peaked in value. So, but it is, to John's point, it's loose. I only have numbers on loose right now, at really good metrics numbers. It's trended up about $10 in the last 7 years. Right. For a loose copy. For a loose copy. Bearing in mind, the game is digitally available.
My name is so, not loose copy.
And loose copies like a loose copy frequently you,
come on.
No, you don't. You don't. Ninja 5-0 actually peaked back in 2013, actually. But yeah, to your point, a complete copy of that currently goes for $259, a new one over $500. This goes back to the conversation we had during the first summer of Too Hot for Games, where it's becoming prohibitively expensive to do these kind of dumpster dives, because the GameCube is of that same era. It's perhaps a little bit newer, but I think consoles are probably more likely to have a nostalgia attachment to them.
Yeah,
because there's always something a little bit disposable about handheld games, and in that era, especially where there was so many of the damn things coming out, and so many of them weren't
classics,
good. Nobody's lining up to buy Corey in the house. Games that can be nostalgic, or you have to bear in mind: does this game have appeal to someone who is now 15 years older than the target market for the game originally?
Yeah. Well, the thing
and
is,
I'm going to tell you right
with,
now
with GBA games, the thing that I think makes them unique is the. Is the cardboard cases. So, in other words, it's very hard to find them in good shape. Now, they've gone away from that completely with the DS and the 3DS. Yeah, and that's part of the reason why I wanted to get rid of these, because I don't want to move these things again and run the risk of the boxes getting crushed.
Right, because they are shockingly fragile. And there is kind of a I mean, this trend does go back when you go back to the old cartridge systems of like these complete inbox for an NES game is semi-valuable regardless of what the game is for the most part, just because, I mean, cardboard deteriorates and it's hard to maintain.
Yep.
And people just tossed it because I have this big plastic cart. It's fine. I don't need to protect it.
Yeah.
But I think you are kind of at the right moment for selling this stuff. I think the risk you run in waiting, although history hasn't really borne this out as much as I expected, is as these games become available on digital platforms, their value would decrease. And that is the case on hyper rare games. Mm-hmm. Cool. Any other observations?
No, that's it, man.
All right, cool. So I have been playing, I went out and I decided that I was going to go look up something to play for this week, and I sort of been caught in a thrall of these these rhythm games.
It's a popular term.
Yeah.
For this episode.
Maybe you just deposited it in my brain, so it's slipped my mind here. This week I have a game for the 3DS eShop called Radio Hammer, all one word. I believe, based on what I have read on this game, that this is, because it's one of those games where it just sort of arrived on the eShop, and it was one of those games that it just sort of showed up in the eShop. It wasn't a big deal. It kind of, what's the way of putting it? It just sort of, it's one of those also out this week kind of games on the on the press release.
Right.
What it is essentially is it is a port of a mobile game, which, you know, eShop ports of mobile games are by and large a red flag. But this one is a little bit different. So it's a rhythm game, much like last week's game, and there is something similar about this title in that you are playing a DJ who essentially has to hit people who are rushing at them with a giant hammer to the music. I will call the story to be very light. So essentially it's a two-track rhythm game where people coming at you from one of the two tracks, and you have the dots, right, that kind of collapse down right as they reach the optimum striking place for your hammer. And basically they come running at you in rhythm with the music. You know, there's different note patterns based on the song you're doing. And there's a sort of like weird, like cutesy veneer. I believe this game is actually Korean in origin, which makes kind of an oddity on the eShop. There's not many of those. But Arc System Works was responsible for this particular version of the game. So the music that it's all set to feels a lot like the background. So let me just step back. The first character you play as is this like bubbly, cute cartoon. I mean, they're all cartoon characters. It was like bubbly, cute DJ, where she constantly reminds you how cute she is. Her victory celebration is taking a selfie of herself. I mean, it's, you know, it's out there. And her manager is a rabbit in a pantsuit. Regular scale rabbit, but with a human body, it's unsettling. And basically the premise is that she's at the park and there are all these people, all these men in trench coats with like ball caps and shades on running at her. And if they get to her, they flash her, and at which point one of them explains they are perverts here for the perv con, and she needs to get rid of them, and that is her decision. And it's fine. A lot of her music sounds like the backing tracks to K-pop music, which is appropriate. But the game kind of violates, like, control-wise, it's fine. You press up to swing up, you press down to swing down. Occasionally, gifts pop up behind you, so you press back to pick those up. Sometimes they're trapped, so you kind of have to pay attention to those while watching rhythms that can get relatively hectic. And, you know, it's fun, and make sure you don't grab the bad gifts. Like I said, it's a fun game. There are sins this game commits, though, against the rhythm game genre that I didn't know you could commit. First off, all the tracks are backing tracks. They're like the rhythm to a rap song. They don't loop very long. They're pretty short, like a minute plus, like somewhere in that range. And while they're fine, they have good heavy beats, so they're pretty easy to play the game to. They don't always have notes on the beat. Like, even hard beats don't necessarily have notes. So there's a real possibility of just, like, you expect to hit a note and there's nothing to do. So it's much more about what you're seeing than something we talked about last week, like Owen Don 2. The individual component, the singular... There's two gameplay modes, and one's just a variant on the other. But basically, you could talk about them like they're more or less the same. It feels like a mini game out of Rhythm Heaven, and I think that's why it works, because it feels like it is a rhythm game out of Rhythm Heaven. So Like, it feels good. It's just sometimes the music doesn't have notes where you'd expect it to have them. But more pressingly, because this music is very short, levels aren't based around a song. Sometimes they are. But many times, it'll be a song, a load screen, a song, a load screen, a song, a load screen, a song, level complete. So you get like these bite-sized songs with gaps between them. The background doesn't change, or if it does, it goes to a background you've already seen before. So having load screens in a rhythm game, like in the middle of gameplay, is way worse than I ever expected it to be. Like, it's really bad, but I've never encountered it because no one's ever been crazy enough to do it. But what's more interesting is, though, the game repeats music. Like, that, it's such a bad feeling to hear the same song for the third or fourth time on a rhythm game when you didn't screw up, when you beat it. It's just the music comes back in there. So while the game is very charming, it's very colorful, the art style is very nice, the second DJ is more of like a rock DJ, his hammer's got like stars all over it, he's more rough. His manager is a cat with a pompadour who's regularly like lighting the end of it on fire. And he's fighting zombies. There's a style to this game. It's cool. It's got this attitude. It's not like the standard, like, weird Japanese depiction of, man, this game's got attitude. And unfortunately, in the rhythm genre, that's a lot of what you see, because that's a lot of where these games come out of, at least in the 3DS space. Like, it does have a different feel than those games. It's in that respect, it's cool to see that. And the mechanics work. The gameplay works. It's the music that they've paired it to is fine. It's just in the execution, like the details of like, hey, the music should probably be long enough for the stage. Hey, there probably shouldn't be loading screens. Hey, the background should change more between levels. And maybe, hey, don't repeat your music. But like, it's weird because I played it for about 40-ish minutes and got through the first character stages, and it was fine. And it, you know, I was enjoying it, but I just couldn't get over like all these things of like, why'd you do that?
And it's, I wonder, just if that's padding. Just... It sounds like that's the equivalent, yeah, I wonder of if padding just... in a rhythm game.
Yeah, I wonder if it's just the mobile game lineage at play. Like, there's this weird, like, well, we don't want to make the game huge because it's a mobile game. People are probably going to pay $1 for it, so we don't want to put a bunch of money into the music. Like, a lot of the music just sound like backing tracks, which is weird. It's weird to play a rhythm game where it so painfully feels like there's supposed to be vocals here, but there just aren't. And I wonder if maybe there were vocals in the Korean version. Again, I believe it's Korean. I can't remember. And unfortunately, there's not much to go on written on this game because it did originally start in the mobile space. And it's not as well documented as the stuff that we deal with. And Arc System Works handled everything on the 3DS. So that's all we have for them. It's cool. Like, I like this game well enough. It's just... there's something about it that just doesn't quite land right. And it's lots of little things like that. Execution issues I didn't know people could have. I've just never heard of people having these kinds of problems in a game. And, you know, like the boss fight. So when you get to her boss, which is the last stage, which, by the way, is like 10 stages too late considering the music's repeating. It's cool. Like, it's a robot. Like, the perverts made a giant robot of her because they were attracted to her with, quotes, two major differences. And then the two people who made them argue about whether or not they like their women equipped with ballistics, to quote a certain Resident Evil character. And they just shoot missiles at her, and you hit the back and it blows up. It's like, it's a cool boss fight. And that one has a long enough song to go for the whole stage, and it just works. And like, I'm torn because this game plays really well for what it is. It's just, what it is isn't much. And that's a weird thing. Like, it gets so much stuff right that to get such fundamental things wrong is kind of weird. And I didn't pay much for it, so I'm not upset that Radio Hammer didn't live up to my expectations, what expectations I had for it. But I had fun with it. I just, you know, if you really like rhythm games, maybe go look at the eShop, see if you're interested in it. I can't recommend it, though. It's fun, but there's just something amateur hour-ish about it sometimes that just grates on my nerves. So, all right, that's gonna do it for new business this week. After the break, we'll be back with your listener mail. It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. week, we have a feature. The NWR Pokemon Sun and Moon Starter Debate. With all the drama of the Trump and Clinton debate, we dissect the three new starters of Pokemon Sun and Moon and give the results of our recent Twitter and Patreon polls. Do you want a fiery kitten, a clown seal, or an owl with a bow tie? Why are grown-ass men talking about this right now? I mean,
grown-ass man, James. Grown-ass man.
Talking about owls with a bow tie. Ties.
Yeah.
Why is it that the grass starters always look like friggin' weirdos? But like, I'll take a bow tie. You know what? I'll take a bow tie.
You're a clown seal though. I sure.
Thanks, John. Speaking of, we have a review: Olympia Rising on Wii U by Don Koopman. Don ventures into the underworld in this Olympus-themed platformer and gives us his review. He already lives in an underworld of terrible games, so he didn't have to travel that far.
Very true.
Are you implying that Olympia Rising might also not be above board?
He thought it was okay.
You know what? That's good for him.
If I recall.
So that's actually... He's getting to experience a good game.
Yeah, I don't know if I can necessarily trust his reviews anymore due to some of the trauma that he's been through, but... Alright, and we have a video, Nintendo News Reports, the Mario Cinematic Universe. Neil, Zach, and Donald dig into this week's news and talk about Mario 1 film, RPGs, of course, because it is the summer of no games and RPGs, and anything that comes out of Zach Miller's mouth, always a wild card. Check out their take on the week's events. And we have, of course, we have a reminder here for the NWR Patreon. Don't forget to check out our Patreon page and become a subscriber. You'll get exclusive content and content before everybody else. So don't hesitate to subscribe. Subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll make it worth your while.
I'll make it worth your while. Hell. We'll make it worth your while right now and all the time at NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back. It's time for listener mail, and I have not put the emails in the chat. Hold on one second.
It's hard to find good help these days.
Yeah, isn't that my line?
It's really hard. We pay top dollar, and this is what we get.
I don't get paid.
I thought we were paying for James Jones that used to play for the Packers or whatever.
Did we get the wrong guy?
Yeah. There was that James Jones that was in the military. He was quite high ranking. Yep. And then somehow we just ended up with the James Jones who'd already been making the podcast for like six years.
I think they swapped it like when James got, like when he thought it was going to be like the Xbox and he got like boots or something in the box. I think it's like that.
God damn it. Take your fucking emails. It's time for listener mail. And if you want to email us, you can email us at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Much like these people did. Greg, you have the first email.
So, Buttle writes, hey guys, Guillaume's comments on Thomas Was Alone got me thinking. Podcasters often give their thoughts on games while they are early on in the game. Certainly this is not always the case, but many times podcasters won't tell the listeners their thoughts after they finish the game. Sometimes the conversation has moved on to whatever the new hot thing is, or perhaps they moved on from the game and didn't see the ending. There have been certain games that podcasters have really talked up where I've not enjoyed the second half or the final third of the game, and there are other games that podcasters have dismissed where I found that the game really shined when I'd mastered it, and a casual playthrough of the early parts of the game wouldn't have shown that. Before podcasts, we mainly just learned about the game from the people who had completed it. Do you think this change has had any effect on how gamers purchase and play games, or even how developers create games?
That's kind of an interesting situation to think about, really, because there is definitely, in how they promote games, in the last 3 or 4 years, I've definitely seen a pivot in how games are promoted, how demos are constructed, but not to service podcasters, to service more streamers. You'll see these demos that are built around, well, PT. PT is a great example. That thing, that demo was built for streamers.
You're talking about the Konami Silent Hill kind of demo,
yes.
Right?
The Kojima Guillermo del Toro joint.
Right.
Yeah, like that thing felt like it was being built to get streamers to stream it, essentially. And it was wildly successful at that.
But it's there is definitely some PR driven stuff there. I don't know that they even give podcasts time of day though. You know, I mean, that sounds mean. That's not, and it's not, was not my intention.
I kind of want to jump on the idea that before podcasts, mainly reviewers had completed the games. I listen to Player One podcast with former EGM writers, and there's ongoing jokes about some of them, like sometimes not touching for very long a particular game before reviewing it. So I don't think it was policy to finish the game before reviewing it.
Yeah, and, I remember. I think Edge did an article on ones like Age of Red about the time Wind Waker came out, like where they had kind of tracked, like, you know, like the play times on games where, you know, that there was a save file there that they could check after they'd handed out the assignment and all this. And yeah, it doesn't sound like it was necessarily that widespread.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, with like for certain genres, you don't need to play all the way to the end, anyways, really. To get the idea,
or the end may not be that well defined.
Yeah,
like what would be the end? You know, in certain cases, it's not really.
I think the other thing worth noting. Well, I think the thing worth noting that both the outlets you just mentioned have one determining factor is that they're print, and they have hard deadlines.
Yeah.
So, and that's they may not have had much time with the game, but god damn it, the cover article of this game is going to be Grand Theft Auto 3, so you better have your review ready. I don't care how much you've played of it. There was the infamous Driver 3 situation where the official PlayStation magazine and Xbox magazines had their reviews like 2 months early, and just I would say based on the quality of that game when it came out, they filleted that game. And it came out, and it was a hot mess. Now was it because that was how they paid for getting the exclusive? I don't know, but like, there's no way they had gotten much time with the game. But I will say that in general, when I reviewed games, I had played them a lot more than when I talk about them than when I had first talked about them on this show. And it's kind of the nature of the beast in that podcasts are weekly. You know, we have to have something new to talk about, or we try to, most weeks. And sometimes, you know, you end up with something that maybe you're only going to play it 35 minutes, just so you have a feel for what the game is. And you
I mean,
talk about
well,
it.
Podcasts have a different kind of time imperative compared to print, which sometimes can be trying to go for immediacy. You know,
right.
I mean, especially for shows that maybe can get out faster than ours does because of the post-production issues, you know, that we have to do, piecing it together across multiple continents and all that stuff. But, you know, so it's like, okay, well, game came out today, play it for a while, you know, and let's get some impressions out there, because that's when a lot of people are going to be searching for impressions or something, you know, because they want to make a purchase decision maybe pretty soon, or they're just curious. And, you know, sometimes I've had games like that, you know, like when I first got Star Fox Zero, I had it the day of recording, so I played it for about an hour and a half, gave impressions there, but then I always do try and follow up with something more substantial.
Yeah, afterwards. I think that's still valid, though. I mean, I think it's still valid.
No,
say,
it absolutely
this
is.
This is my first impression of the game. I mean,
yeah,
because
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I don't really think that's ever. I don't think that the beginning of a game pulling you in has ever not been important. Like,
no,
yes,
because
yeah,
I think because you could talk about print, you can talk about streaming, podcasts, whatever. Word of mouth is a big deal, you know, in any time period you're talking about. And that is going to be affected a lot by the beginning of a game. You know, when it's just kids on the playground, people at the water cooler, whatever it was, it's the 80s, 90s, 2000, whatever. You know, like, that was always important, and it still is, of course. Maybe it's been kind of accelerated now, to some extent, because it's so easy to share your opinions instantly and across borders and all that kind of stuff. But I imagine it wasn't so terribly different, you know, for kids speaking amongst themselves about, you know, well, I just, you know, oh, yeah, you just got that game. What do you think of it? You know, you don't necessarily, I'll ask him in a fortnight when he's got a fully formed opinion of the game.
It definitely is important from the perspective of marketing. Starting hot is important. And it's important, not for every game,
But it's but
they, I mean, they're all, I mean, just like, I mean, I made comments about this back, you know, in years ago when I got a PS3 and I played a lot of it was a few years into that generation, so I picked up a bunch of its sort of most prominent games pretty close together. And there was a quite discernible pattern about the ends of those games kind of falling all off, like they didn't.
Mm.
They didn't particularly care if it left a great taste in your mouth, or they just ran out of time with development, whatever. It was much more concerned about it being front-loaded, you know, to me, it seemed like. And again, I think that's, you could say, you know, maybe that was kind of about, you know, how it would test with people like, you know, that might talk about it on podcasts and stuff, but I think it's probably just more a general word-of-mouth thing. And I guess the streaming stuff now, the YouTube stuff, all that, it kind of has accelerated that to some extent. I think, you know, turbocharged it. I think maybe the one thing you could say now is that I would say if anything was going to affect the way people put together their games now, it probably would be streaming rather than podcasts or any other kind of media.
Absolutely.
Because there's just so much passive kind of consumption of games now that I never really would have anticipated myself years ago. That it seems to be an absolutely crucial way to get your game out there, just for it to sort of rise above the noise.
Away a little bit from what we've been talking, I just think in general, the developers' experience with their past releases is going to inform how they're going to work on their next game. Like, I don't think it's really like podcasts or streamers or reviews or just general word of mouth. I think that probably most people learn by doing, right? Or by how their work was received. And it's an old example at this point, but I just remember David Jaffe, he was pretty open about, like, when he was working on God of War, and there was a section towards the end of the game that was not really polished, and he said, like, yeah, we worked on the game kind of chronologically, you know, like, we worked on the first level first, and, you know, we worked our way up, and towards the end of the game, we didn't really have time to test the final level, and we thought, well, that's probably fine. And then it turns out that that part of the game was really frustrating. So then for subsequent games, like he said that he would probably pay more attention to the ending, perhaps work on the first level at the end, because then it's going to be the most polished and the most kind of the most, like, you know, he'll have learned from the project and he'll probably put out a better first level than if he had started with it, right? So just, I don't know, like the developers pick up these this experience and talk to each other and pick up these tricks, and doesn't have anything to do with podcasts. It just has to do with kind of learning how to make games and what works
and what
doesn't.
The types of games that are popular are also different too now. I mean, there's less narrative focused games. There's a lot more open world games, games that technically have no ending, a lot of stuff
games
like that.
Games that are technically more sandboxes than games.
Exactly.
I mean, there's definitely a genre that has popped up as response to streaming with things like Spooky's House of Jump Scares. I mean, it's in the name what that game is. Like, now it does subvert a lot of its genre mates by most of the jump scares, at least at the beginning, are these cute things that pop out on cardboard. And they're literally just jump scares. It's kind of a parody. But it's doing that because it understood that 19 Nights at Freddy has just sort of worn that thing out. And it's being more of an entertainment product. It's building an experience not unlike, you know, a TV show or a movie versus a gameplay mechanic. It's trying to be entertaining. It's trying to be entertaining to watch, not necessarily just to play.
And
I mean, that's definitely a thing that's come out of the streaming genre. Those games wouldn't have the market they have otherwise, but that's not what, I don't know if that's fed into game design as a whole. I mean, it's created this weird sub niche of things where if you were to show them to somebody from 10 years ago, they'd go, "What the fuck is that?" But I don't know. Maybe we're too close to the storm. It would be interesting. It would be interesting if people came back to us, and we actually got an email speaking to this a little bit, and you know, sort of asked, you know, or pointed out to us when maybe we
didn't give good information about a game's more deep and nuanced content because we only played the very beginning of it. Like, I would be curious if we are guilty of this sin, because it's something that's very hard from your own perspective to judge, I would imagine.
Well, so if a game takes too long to get going, I just it can lose me as a player, and it can lose other people. So I think that the initial kind of bad impression is still a valuable one, because it is
an important thing. I mean, I think to some of what Bottled say as well. I mean, I think there's an important place for coverage of a game, you know, after it comes out and looking back at stuff, not necessarily in a hardcore retro way like we do with sort of retroactive, where it's decades old or something, but just maybe a few months later, especially because games now are becoming more evolving, Splatoon, that kind of Mario Maker, where they're really quite different games just as the weeks roll by, when new things get added and all that. But even games that are more static, I think there is value in, now you've been able to kind of appreciate the totality of it and all that kind of stuff, coming back to things. But, I mean, NWR does that with revisits and things like that. I think that's quite good. Like I said, personally, with I'd usually try and wait. Like Mario Luigi, for instance, I'm definitely really close to the end. I don't think what's left is going to have much of a material effect on my general impressions of the game. So while I will give early impressions, I do like to try and get something more in-depth afterwards. Well, obviously, if that's not always going to happen, it's not always going to be possible. But, there's other, I think that's where, like a site like ours, I think does a pretty good service, because it's good to look at a game, not just when you've had more time to play it, but maybe just outside of the bubble of it at the time it was released as well. Mm-hmm. There's a certain amount of hype and maybe even a certain amount of groupthink that goes on when everybody's playing it at the same time and they're talking about it on Twitter and stuff like that. Coming back to it afterwards with a bit of a different perspective, I think could be valuable, because, not everybody's buying everything at release and all that kind of stuff, or they're just interested to hear how their experiences match up with those of others. I think it's a cool thing you could do with podcasts and various other media.
Yeah, and sometimes, I would like to go back to a game or to talk about a game because I've gone back to it, and I'm not sure if people are interested. Sometimes I think, this game that I'm playing and I feel really good about, and I think that people are going to, commenters are going to pick it up and get back to me on it, and then there's nothing, right? And so I don't feel really compelled to talk about it again, or I feel like, well, I probably can find something more interesting or newer to talk about in the podcast, and then the cycle begins anew.
That's the kind of hot new thing, the component of Bottled's Letter, isn't it? To some extent, and I'm sure that's probably a lot more prominent on podcasts other than ours that don't like tag team mid-2000s import DS games for their currently playing segments or whatever.
Right, but I think the best way to get updates from me would be, on Twitter, you talked about this game. But that might push me to talk about it again on the podcast. Although sometimes
I guess that's kind of what Miiverse is for a little bit as well, I guess.
Also on Miiverse, I still check it pretty regularly.
Got to get those Nintendo points. I'm going to get the platinum.
It's true.
Gorilla.
25 days of Miiverse. Just go out there and every day give a new sketch of whatever game you've been playing. So I assume it's going to be a lot of horses drawn with various forms of hattery. And you can look forward to Guillaume's Miiverse sketches. Horses and hats. It's a 25-part series. We've gone way off stream. Guillaume, you can read the next email.
Sure. GX writes, "Dear RFN crew, I found myself with an odd nostalgic pang as of late. Let us go back to the GBA, when THQ was king of games based on Nickelodeon sitcoms about boy bands and generic platformers based on bad CGI films. Sadly, weird licenses attached to games today are only that prolific on mobile, leaving console and portable platforms with dying Toys to Life games, Lego games, dying Toys to Life Lego games, more Telltale games than are medically advisable, and Nintendo teaching you how to draw Frozen characters. What are your favorite garbage or conceptually nonsense licensed games from the GBA, DS, or Wii era? What modern licenses would you want to see as GBA era style licensed games? And how do you envision them? Thanks for 10 years of great podcasts, and here's hoping for 40 more. Jesus Christ.
I can give you 20, no. Maybe. Maybe.
You monster.
Before I need a feeding tube.
Before you die?
I promise to go beyond the end. I promise to go beyond the end of civilization. Personally, I think he's been a bit optimistic there, but there you go.
Why would you wish 40 years of this on anyone?
Alright, I would say garbage.
Go ahead, John.
I would say garbage or conceptually nonsense licensed games. I think it'd be fair to say that anything with Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen would probably fall into that category.
And I had a little sister wheelhouse age. Yes.
I got an interesting one that's apparently was not garbage, but certainly seems like it's in the nonsense phase. There was a David Beckham mascot platformer for the GBA. It sounds like it should be the worst game
so
ever made.
Though,
but
please tell me he was digitized like in Mortal Kombat.
No, he
Forever.
Was like he was kind of like cutesy.
You've unlocked Victoria Beckham.
Yeah, GB kind of David Beckham.
Whoa.
It seems like it should be really terrible, but I think it was actually not discussed at length on New Business or anything, but it was name checked on this show before we did it. I can't remember if it's Mike Sklens or whether Johnny talked. Apparently, it's not terrible, that Beckham game. It's kind of a decent platform. It seems like you would swear, you know, anything with that concept would be dire, but apparently it's not. So, but that just shows you how crazy that era was. For
at the end of every level, he saves a different Spice Girl. I suppose.
I don't think he.
Is it Go Go Beckham Adventure on Soccer Island? Oh my God! It is.
Yeah. That's
wow.
It.
That is from 2002. A platformer developed by Denki.
Yeah.
Published by
Rare
Software.
You know, that explains it being at least decent. I mean, Genki was good at those games. I mean, it just is. So funnily enough, though. You mentioned the Mary-Kate and Ashley games, and like I said, I had a sister who was right in that age wheelhouse. So like all that shit came in, and generally speaking, it just turned into, all right, well, we're gonna see how bad this is. There's no way it can even be remotely playable. So there was the game where they went to the mall, and that was a fucking disaster of a game. Like, that was just terrible. Mary-Kate and Ashley's Mystery Mall.
The choice of shoes was just atrocious.
Yeah, it was really bad. But like all the mini games were really strange. And like there's a skiing mini game in the mall, which is a little odd. Like they had made it for a different game, but it missed the deadline for that game, so they just threw it in this one. And then there was like a Pokemon Snap thing with boys, which was always a favorite of ours to play and just laugh at for a while. Because they added like commentary on top of it, but it was just randomly generated what comment it picks. So it was almost always non sequiturs. So, like, I'm only going to take pictures of mailboxes. Wow, look how cute he is. I'm like, well, that's a mailbox. So, all right, girls.
Oh, wow.
But there was one Mary-Kate and Ashley game that she got for the Game Boy Color that was actually pretty good. And the reason it was pretty good is it was just Lost Vikings. And they had just recovered it in Mary-Kate and Ashley plus a dog. And that was... It was just Lost Vikings. That's it. And it worked fine. It played pretty well. It was easier than Lost Vikings, obviously. But, I mean, mechanically, it worked just fine.
It's the kind of thing you got a lot in the NES era, that where, you know, a game would come over somewhere and get a completely separate license just kind of slapped on it. And, you know, like that. That still kind of went on in the GBA era. It feels really quaint now, but, yeah.
Like, it was
What was it? Was it Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse? Yeah, there's some series of games where in one country it's Bugs Bunny and elsewhere it's Mickey Mouse and vice versa.
Yeah, and of course then you had where they went the other way. Like Sunsoft was making a Terminator game and then it couldn't be Terminator, so it was Journey to Silius.
Right. Yeah.
So there's a couple that are like, so the era he's mentioning, and I referenced it earlier with Corey in the house. So there was this weird period where Game Boy Advance games, especially in Game Boy Color, basically, if you had a show on Disney or Nickelodeon, you got a game, almost as if it was part of the contract. And it's possible it was part of the contract, and we just don't know that. And these games were universally terrible, like just dreck, the worst dreck in the world, because these games were cheap to make. So they were basically merch. They weren't games. And yeah. They weren't made like games. They were made like merchandise. And so what you had is you had this generation of live action, you know, these live action TV shows where they took pictures and digitized them of the actors onto the Game Boy Color using the Game Boy Color palette. And it looked like crap because obviously the Game Boy Color was not meant to display pictures and it did a poor job of it. But a lot of times they would just sort of wrap the same kind of really basic gameplay mechanics around a game that doesn't really need it. If you understand how Disney produces their sitcoms, the Disney Channel basically has this, like, sitcom has a 5-year run. At that point, the target audience for this show is too old to enjoy it anymore, and people who are now in age won't care because they weren't there from the beginning. So your show runs 5 seasons, we dump you, and we start over no matter how popular you are. And that means that, and if every game gets a show, that means they produced a lot of games, and that, I mean, it flooded the market with this stuff. And I think ultimately that's part of the reason you don't see them anymore. Not just because that market moved to the Game Boy or moved to the mobile space, but because it's too expensive to make them and they made too many. Like there's only so many Raven Simone starred Game Boy Advance games one person can buy, but I think there's 3. So at some point, like, what's your saturation point? It should probably be 0.
Well, and you also had great, just looking at the list of GBA games, I mean, I'm only down to B, and there's some pretty classic ones. Barbie. Actually, that's an interesting game. Done by WayForward, Barbie and the Magic of Pegasus. It's very interesting. But the one that brings to mind some terrible games, published by BAM Entertainment.
Spiderwick Chronicles.
Ballistic. X versus Sever and Ballistics X versus Sever 2. It was so good they had to have a sequel. It was that
good.
Well,
no, that was a really early GBA game, wasn't it? That was didn't they end up like coming out quite a bit before the movie, and then
it did because the movie
didn't. Yeah, the movie wasn't even called X versus Sever anymore. I mean,
it was called Ballistic.
Right.
I can't imagine why you'd want to get away from a catchy title like that. Yeah, that was a really weird situation. That was where the game ended up probably had more of a foothold in the mind share. Than the movie ended up doing, just because it was early GBA, you know, there was an opportunity there. The market was not yet flooded at that stage.
And also it was a first-person shooter.
Yeah.
Which was not, they were not, you know, we didn't get a ton of them on the GBA, so
yeah, I mean,
it was a novelty. But like the game came out so early, it was based on, like, I guess a script, and then the movie came out and critics got confused and thought it was based on a video game, when in fact,
yes,
it was.
Wow,
you know,
it's not the opposite of GoldenEye.
A lot of these
BAM Entertainment, Majesco, THQ, like, oh, just Jesus.
Now, so, there is an important element to the question about what license.
Well, hold on.
I've got two
that I really want to mention. So Europe is especially guilty in the DS era, specifically Deep Silver, who are just a disaster of a publisher. But they own the Russell Grant Astrology infamous DS game, which is one of the greatest DS box arts I've ever seen. It probably needs to be the chapter art for this segment.
I wonder if I ever use that as a chapter
art. it's special. His bloated face on the cover, grinning at you. But the one that I remember from when I was younger, it was Sox Rocks the Hill.
The game that didn't come out. The Bill Clinton cat game.
Yeah, it was a finished game about Bill Clinton's cat for the Super Nintendo.
Wow.
That ultimately didn't come out because they were, I don't know if they just weren't sure if, like, hey, maybe this is going to be a problem.
from a legal standpoint, he's a public figure, but like the cover was the cat coming out of a sacks of a crudely drawn Bill Clinton. It's like that would
was
be something.
Was there ever a well drawn Bill Clinton? Come on.
Probably, yes. That sounds like something that was going to be our answer.
Depends on how you define drawn, I guess. True.
That sounds like something that would be our answer for the next part of this question, which, Greg, if you would please.
Yeah, so that whole thing about what license would you like to sort of take back in time, essentially, and put through the filter of those at the time, you know, that GBA era kind of license game. For me, I think pretty much all the Telltale, all the franchises that are done in Telltale now should just be turned into like side-scrolling, like Contra or Final Fight rip-offs. Just to just totally drain them of any moral choices or anything.
Just like the badly digitized voice yelling out at you.
I'm just thinking like Game of Thrones, Walking Dead, you know, instead of all these like all this moral ambiguity or machinations or someone will remember that. It's just you just walking from left to right, killing everything.
That still seems Game of Thrones thematically appropriate.
Well, it could be. I mean, because it's like, if you remember even something, you know, as sort of straightforward as Star Wars, like in Super Star Wars, the cantina scene is you shooting everything that moves, including like stuff that only existed on Chewie's fucking holographic chessboard. Like, it wasn't even in the cantina. They don't even really exist, but you're shooting the shit out of it. Like, that's what I want to see. You know, I want to see Game of Thrones given that treatment, where you're just shooting characters that haven't been alive for years. Anything, you know, that kind of nonsense is definitely been lost, I think.
So yeah, I looked it up, and look up Crazy Castle series on Wikipedia if you want to have some fun with the Roger Rabbit game that Mickey Mouse game that became a Bugs Bunny game that became a Ghostbusters game.
Zool actually is in there too, which was not a licensed game. It became a licensed game. And was itself like a rebrand of another license that was itself then rebranded again. And ultimately, in its third iteration, its third name became Gingerbread Man.
Nice.
So I think, I'm trying to think what media property cries out to the world for a game. So historically, all of these Marvel Cinematic Universe game movies would have had games, and in fact, the first ones did. There was that truly horrific Iron Man game.
Now hold on. Are we talking taking a property from today and giving it the THQ treatment of making an awful GBA game out of it? I just want to set the ground rules for this thought experiment.
I think that's an interpretation you could take. You can also say like giving it if THQ hadn't decided to make a million UDraw tablets and hadn't literally taken money outside and just burned it and still lived, what would they be doing today? I think that's also a valid consideration point. I like Greg's GBA interpretation of it.
Memorial BMX. Probably.
Oh, that's too soon.
It's just tasteless enough that THQ would probably
it
do
is.
It.
I mean, you're right.
That's the sad thing about it.
I'm trying to. So there was a house DS game, I believe, on the. That's kind of where I would have gone, but that already happened. So I'm trying to think what would be modern and
house,
troubling.
A really terrible Zero Mission player, if you remember from the early before he bailed out and went and gone to the PSP. He played Zero Mission.
Well, they'd make a game for Jurassic World. That's for damn sure. Besides a Lego game.
Yeah,
that's got the right amount of dopey in the movie.
Yep.
To go even dopier with it, and
we've
got to
go. We've
got
to go doper. Yeah. I would start to think like what would be an appropriate like game to make a puzzle platformer media property to make a puzzle platformer out, and I think Better Call Saul is in there. Like, you could go back to the Origin series, and I think that's a little too puzzle platformy. I like the idea of Saul having to get through his legal cases by platforming around with a dog and his identical twin and using them Lost Viking style. I think that, like,
that could work.
Collecting evidence by having to bounce off a dog who has, like, who's basically got the rush coil built into him. I think that really works for that franchise. I think it really fits that character. And I think it would be a complete piece of garbage. And that fits Saul better than anything else.
Yeah, It would be terrible and completely unnecessary.
So I don't have a whole lot of experience with the THQ GBA games, but...
not me neither.
Thank God for that.
No, but I mean, I wasn't around with the website. You know, I didn't have to review bad games, but for whatever reason, my mind is flashing to the bad NES Superman game where you could go in phone booths and change into Superman and Clark Kent, and it was really confusing. So I'm imagining that, but with a palette swap to make it a Bridesmaids game, and instead of changing into Superman, you're just taking a shit in a faucet, in the sink. And that's the game. You just go in various doors and find places to shit.
You just made a joke funnier than that entire movie.
Well, I like the movie. But also, I think it's pretty good because in the Crazy Castle tradition, you could just swap it to like Ghostbusters later. And now the Ghostbusters have to find a places to take a shit. Yeah. Great. It's I don't know. It's very low effort, low budget, and it works.
I would say I would like to see them make a game out of... Well, they did make a Daredevil game. Not Daredevil. They did make a Deadpool game, and it was obnoxious. I would like to see them make a Deadpool game and try to keep the spirit of the movie, but also not get an AO rating. It would fail, and it would be awful. But I'd like to see them try. I'd like to know that game is back in front of the ESRB for the third time, and they're like, no, this time we're getting the MA. I feel good about it. All right, John, what do you got?
I don't really know. I mean, I was just thinking, like, you know, it would be something that could be... I mean, extreme sports are still around, but I mean, they're not really like Johnny Mosley Mad Tricks Extreme. And I don't really know.
In San Francisco, no.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not too sure, but it would be something along that line, like you know, something Johnny Mosley Matrix is, because I just really miss that game.
It's always with you in your heart, John.
It is.
If you branch in outside of the THQ, like what I'm imagining, a side boilerplate side scroller action game thing, I'm thinking Twin Peaks is coming back next year. I'm thinking a Twin Peaks roguelike set in the Black Lodge. So it all looks the same. It's just all red drapes and black and white floors, randomly created dungeons. Yeah, you've got to get out. That's the game. I think somebody made an Atari game that was kind of like that, but I assume it was just like a high school thing. I'm thinking James' favorite genre, the roguelike, would be perfect.
Yeah, I think for my game would be, I've been thinking about it, like kind of like USC, like MMA is really hot right now, so I'm thinking, hear me out here, Kimbo Slice Mad Tricks. Kimbo Slice, throw that guy on skis and let him take... Not San Francisco, because San Francisco costs too much. Omaha, Nebraska by storm.
It's kind of like MMA Shaq Fu. Is that what you're telling me?
Exactly what I'm thinking about.
Infamously flat middle of the country.
They'll truck in the snow. It's all good. Don't worry. It'll totally work out.
Who a guy I am incapable of picturing in a shirt in the snow. Thanks, John. All right. Hey, guys. If you could retire a Nintendo character, which one would it be and why? Why would you
Samus is already retired, so that's not an option.
All right,
Bill. I'm pretty sure we had a question like this many years
Don't
ago.
Don't cry for me, I'm already dead.
My response was that John would have wanted all of them retired.
Oh, man. If I could retire a Nintendo character. Let me think on this. Give me a second here.
All right. See, my feeling is I'm not so much like looking at this as retiring a franchise when you retire a character.
No, it's a character. It's a character.
Yeah, so with some, you kind of feel like if you retire the main character, you essentially retire the franchise. But for me, I think there's some recurring villains that could use with retire. I think Ridley has had his chips, as far as I'm concerned, on the Metroid front.
Is that a British expression? He's had his
chips? Is, yeah. He's done.
Okay.
He's cooked.
I just thought he was a big fan of potato products or something.
No, you know, they've done it so many times, and then they've done it too many times, really. Cause it's not like, it's when it's kind of whimsical, like Bowser, it's one thing, and the Ganon thing, well, they've done it a lot of times, but technically it's in different timelines or whatever, I guess. You can get away with it a little more, but at Zelda's more whimsical than
but a lot of times Ridley is screwed up from the last time you fought Ridley. Like,
yeah,
this is Mecha
fact,
Ridley.
Like,
he's got a gun for an eye.
They got themselves in trouble with Other M, where it's like Samus is acting like she's never fought him before when she's fought him a whole bunch of times. You know, it just, that sort of thing wouldn't happen if you just kept bringing him out. You know, it's a cool design, I like, but come on. You know, just have more original boss designs.
Well, I mean, there are other options.
If
Kraid,
when Metroid
and looks
comes
like
back.
Garbage.
Yeah, well, no, see, Kraid doesn't get rolled out all the time.
Because
well,
he looks terrible.
Yeah. Well, he looks really
an awful
terrible
character.
In the original.
Watch out, Metroid. He's gonna shoot his belly button at you. Oh,
it's so bad.
Terrifying. So you know, I think you know, it's not that just design cool new bosses, you know, like she's a bounty hunter or whatever. This whole thing of like, oh, Ridley killed her family, and you know, I always thought I was dopey. You know, it's just, you know, they're creatures. They're hazards, you know?
Right.
Like, I never really got that. So even though I like his design, I'd be quite happy to see him hang it up.
Okay. John, are you ready or do you need more time?
I think they can get rid of Slippy Toad. You can just
no.
You mean Dat Boy? They're gonna get rid
Dat
of Dat Boy? Is that what you're
telling
me?
I think they jumped the shark with that one right there. I mean, the fact that he's like, he's kidding. I mean, come on. Oh. When Dat Boy beats him in a Twitter poll, man, I don't know.
Slippy is terrible. We got an email asking us to get mad about the name Grippy Toad, and they're right. We should be mad about that. That's really offensive.
Yes, that's just more reason. It's more fuel on the like, toad fire, if you will.
The entire toad fire rises is what he's saying here. Yeah, that whole family can go. Let's just say the entire toad line can be exterminated.
Yeah, yes.
All right, retire.
Stick dynamite in their mouth and just let it go.
I feel like there's more efficient ways
Sorry,
to dispose
Geek.
Of toads, John.
Sorry. Hey.
So I guess I'll go next. I would actually really like to see us go ahead and get rid of Luigi. Just get him out of here. He's terrible. No, nice. No. Actually, what I want to see go is I want to either see this is the lines. I'm gonna cheat a little bit. I either want them to do something with Waluigi or get rid of him. Like him being on the periphery is the worst. Because
it's like with Matt, what I was talking about with Paper Jam. Now it's like they've just doing like Mario characters rather than original characters. It's like Nabbit shows up, Toadette shows up. You know, like these characters you wouldn't necessarily expect. No love for Wario and Waluigi. They can never be allowed in those games, apparently.
Because that character is either the most obnoxious thing. People just hate him. And mostly they hate him because he exists singularly to fill out a roster in a party game. Or, like, they love him because in one stupid Mario Tennis opening video, he drew glasses on someone and called them Mr. Eyeballs. Like that's... There's no middle ground on Waluigi for whatever fucking reason. And, like, either it's reached a point where it's just like, shit, I'll get off the pot. Do something with this character or make it go away. I'm tired of hearing about people asking for a Waluigi game and then getting responded to. No, Waluigi's awful. Just do something with him. Also, I would kind of want to play a Waluigi game, I think, and that worries me a lot.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Yo.
So that was actually going to be my pick for the exact same reason, because they haven't really been using him in a good way, so might as well retire him. The problem with that is that of any character in Nintendo's roster, I think Waluigi is the most likely to escape the video game world to try to survive to try to kind of defeat.
I will Mr. Eyeballs you all.
Yeah, like it's like Charlie Dance's character in Last Action Hero.
Exactly. Exactly.
Damn it, I was going to mention Last Action Hero for the last question.
He's gonna come into the real world and he's going to recruit all the other video game villains and take it over because he's just saying, I've just shot somebody and I want to confess. He's, you know,
Exactly. So I think that if Nintendo wants to retire Waluigi, they have to be prepared for that kind of consequence.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, the other option is retire Peach, whom...
the whole her getting kidnapped thing is she can at least be retire from getting kidnapped. Even the jokes in Mario & Luigi about how routine it is have become routine.
Yes.
So like, but it really has turned in on itself hardcore at this point.
There's now a parade of princesses though. Like, if you think about it that way, there is at least two others that they could use. Like, maybe put her away for a while, and also she has the most high-pitched falsetto obnoxious voice, so like it's certainly self-serving there that I'm tired of hearing her squeaky inviting Mario to eat cakes, which basically is just a letter saying, oh, by the way, I'm gonna be kidnapped, just a heads up. But
P.S. you realize this means I'm gonna get kidnapped, right?
We really need to let Bowser stop reading our mail. And on that, we will end this completely uninformative new business segment.
Well, you were just all over the shop there. Normally you get the name of that segment wrong, but you just got the segment wrong there. I'm sorry.
this segment, this listener mail segment, was just like just so much randomness that at some point my brain's just gone and started doing weird stuff, and it's coming up with contrivances to. What would happen if they retired both of those characters at the same time and we ended up with her becoming Wah-Peach? Which is a reality that I'm worried the next Mario Party will make real.
Waluigi and Peach both fall beyond in Chrono Cross, the darkness beyond time, and fuse together to become Wah-Peach, the Dream Devourer, whatever, yeah.
It's just Peach in purple with the mustache.
And then everything you get her, like, the FMV of it walking around Tokyo or whatever.
Oh, God. Yes. But, if you want to send us your emails, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Last week we premiered the new icon for Radio Free Nintendo. It was a long process when we first said we were going to set out and do it. Talking about it on the show, trying to get people involved, getting all those submissions that we got, and ultimately settling on the one we went with. Unfortunately, because we decided we wanted to have it for the 10th anniversary, and we didn't think about it until very soon thereafter, we kind of had to, after waiting for a really long time, we then kind of had to rush to put it all together at the end. We hadn't really talked to the artist about how we should identify him and how we should call him out, and we're in a position we could do that now. So, our artist for the new Radio Free Nintendo logo is Connor Strickland of Kennesaw, Georgia. He has a website, connorstrickland.com, although he says he hasn't updated it for a couple years and doesn't have a lot of game-related stuff on there. He also volunteers at ZeldaUniverse.net, which is a site that a lot of you have probably heard of. It's a Zelda-focused site that I've used in the past. It's a pretty good compendium of Zelda knowledge. He's actually working on their mobile layout and doing their icon development for them. And he wants us to keep a close eye on what they've got coming because they're really hoping we'll enjoy it. And he's very proud to show everybody. I wanted to personally thank him for putting this together and everybody who submitted one. I was blown away by some of the submissions we got. And ultimately, we're really happy with what we have going forward. I mean, I totally dig the new icon. I hope you guys are liking it. I know these guys, you know, we talked about it. It's really cool. And it's showing up everywhere right now, except for Stitcher, where it's still showing the old one. But we're actually now on the Google Play podcast section. Apparently, we've been on Stitcher and we didn't know it. So that's cool. As well as iTunes and on the website and all the other RSS feeds. Guillaume knew. I didn't. We have no control over the listing right now, though. So we're working on that. Last plug, the retroactive. So I know that we said we were going to be doing the retroactive on Castlevania Rondo of Blood next week. However, we're just not ready. It's on us. Life gets us busy sometimes. So we're doing 2 weeks from this episode. So that will be episode 479. Again, the comment thread is open. Go ahead and post your comments. You can send us emails with your comments about them. We will be talking about it then. It is the only Castlevania with door sound effects in the music, so you should really get involved.
I'm not sure that's entirely true. The Castlevania really? 4 soundtrack release involves a door sound effect for the bit where you come into the castle. So,
but is it in the song?
Yeah, if it's in the song on the soundtrack, you've got to think it's considered part of the song, you know, as well.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah.
Maybe you're ignoring the rich history of door sound effects.
Door sound effects as part of music. Anyway, we'll have more of that during the retroactive. So, Greg, what is our music for this week?
We did get, this is a listener request, and I'd be happy to get many more as well. Not that we've done all of them or anything, but please send in anything if you really want to hear it at the end of the show. But given that I talked about Paper Jam this week, we've got a selection from Ben, which is Raphael the Raven's theme from the original Paper Mario back on N64.
Oh, that's a good choice. I had to think about what it was. Yeah. But on that, bye, everybody.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.